Welcome to the Chase Down Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Rowan. The Cleveland Cavaliers are coming off their lowest offensive output of the year, scoring only 83 points against the Oklahoma City Thunder. But that's not what's interesting. They traded Kyle Korver to the Utah Jazz. In exchange for Kyle Korver, they got two first-round picks, including a...
Two first-round picks. That's fascinating.
Two first. Yeah.
What a haul.
What a haul. To be fair, one of them, as I was going to say, is enticing. It's the Washington second round pick, which is almost like a first.
So two second round picks.
Correct.
For our loyal listeners who are, for some reason, getting news from us.
Lord, I hope not. Actually, you know what? That serves you right. If you're getting news from us, this is exactly what you deserve. That snarky voice is my co-host, Carter Rodriguez. Carter, how's it going, buddy?
Going good. I think like every Cavs fan on my timeline, including myself, was like running errands or doing something when the trade came. So like no one was prepared to react to it. So I'm still kind of processing it because I got home and immediately had to watch the game. So looking forward to talking about it.
Absolutely. And to help us talk about it, we have a special guest. We have Andy Bailey here. Andy covers the Jazz for SLC Dunk. As well as works for Bleachers Report and the co-host of the very fun Hardwood Knox podcast. And you might know him from the advanced stats tweet threads that, Andy, be honest, how often, like, I love them, but how often are you looking to get a reaction sometimes out of people?
25% of the time, probably. I'll be completely honest. There's definitely a lot that are, just sort of poking the bear.
Classic Bailey.
I really love it because there are so many times that it brings attention to something where I'm like, I didn't notice that at all. And like, it's something that I'll go back and look at. And it's one of those things, like, advanced stats can be tricky because when there isn't context given to it or when it's just a dump, it's so frequently taken out of context on Twitter. Whereas really it's just another tool that kind of enhances your experience when you're following the game and looking for what's happening.
I'm honestly kind of torn on context sometimes. Like sometimes I will just post stats devoid of context just to see how people will react.
Right. And those were the ones.
By people, you mean Justin.
I'm not sure how many people have caught on to that shtick. It sounds like you guys have, which is I'm glad there are at least some people out there. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people that get really angry at stuff that's really just numbers, and I just throw it out there to see how people will react. So it's kind of funny. Obviously, if I want to make a point about someone, it's obviously a lot better to have some context and be able to flesh it out. So Twitter's just not the best place for that.
Right. And that's typically where you see things more in articles and sometimes like I'm getting better at sniffing it out too. Like, and as you said, typically if it's put completely without any context, I know it's typically, okay, he's not looking to make a point here. It's just, let's see what kind of the reaction is to it. And sometimes like I'll just sit there. I'm like, okay, he's definitely screwing with me. And then immediately with your reaction, I'm like, oh yeah, he's definitely screwing with me right now. But I appreciate it. And I also appreciate you coming on here, Andy. First of all, what was kind of your general reaction to the trade when it first broke? Have you kind of digested a little bit, or are you like Carter and I where it kind of caught you off guard and you're still trying to figure out exactly how you feel about it?
It definitely caught me off guard. I'm still not 100% sure how I feel about it. When the first Woj notification came through and it just said the Jazz are trading for Kyle Korver, speaking of no context,
right?
I just thought, wow, that's perfect. That the Jazz are one of the worst shooting teams in the NBA. Coming into tonight, the only two above average 3-point shooters that they had was Ingles and Burks, mm-hmm. and everybody else was not just below average, like way below average. Like Jay Crowder shoots a ton. Mitchell shoots a ton. They're both under 30%. It's bad. So when I saw...
I was told that an offensive system would fix Jay Crowder's jumper. Someone must have lied to me.
That one Boston season is becoming more and more of a distant memory, huh?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll never forget his Cavaliers half season. I'll tell you that much. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine. I was stoked that they got some shooting, and then, you know, details started to trickle in. 2 second rounders. I thought, that's interesting. You know, second rounders or whatever. If you have a great GM, maybe you strike with those. Maybe you don't. But then I thought, okay, so there's got to be some salary filler somewhere. And when it was Alec Burks, I don't know if it's just like the sentimental Jazz fan in me. This guy's been on the Jazz for 8 years. As someone who likes advanced numbers, it's kind of counterintuitive for me to talk about how I like Alec Burks because they've hated him for most of his career.
Right.
But like I said earlier, he's one of the only above average shooters on this team right now. He was basically the only other guy who could scratch up his own offense every now and then, with the exception of Donovan Mitchell. So they lost some things that I think they needed. And it's just interesting that they're banking so heavily on a 37-year-old Kyle Korver. I'm just going to be really curious to see how it plays out.
It doesn't seem like, I mean, if anything, this trade was just functionally them saying, we don't intend to keep Alec Burks around, right?
Yeah.
Because like, then it's just like, okay, well, we might as well maximize what our roster for this 1 year, and Korver is available. I'm a little surprised, given Burks' status as an expiring, that they had to give up so much compensation. It does feel a little bit like one of those deals that probably shouldn't have been able to work out, like where, like, it feels like they kind of gave the Cavs a lot, but then the Cavs also, like, probably couldn't have taken much less based on what Utah had to offer. So it is a little weird, but I don't know. I do think Korver's going to help you guys. Like, his defense is what it is, but he tries really, really hard. He doesn't make a lot of obvious mistakes. He's still got quick hands.
Right.
And I don't know, man. I always found, even when he was getting cooked, it was like teams would go out of their way to attack him in a way that kind of threw them off rhythm. I don't know if the numbers always bore that out, but I don't know, man. I never felt like he hurt the Cavs, even in the matchups where teams could switch him and really hurt him that and kind of mitigate his impact offensively. And he still hits really tough threes and can get up a bunch of them if you have a good system or have a guy who can destabilize the defense.
Yeah, I think all that stuff is part of why I was initially excited when I saw the Jazz have traded for Kyle Korver. And I still think it can work out for all the reasons that you laid out. And I think Utah can probably put enough plus defenders around him to get away with whatever limitations he has there. I think the thing with Korver's defense for like 3 or 4 years now has been he tries hard.
Right, yeah.
And at 37 years old, there's only so much that trying can do for you, especially for a guy that's really known for lockdown defense or athleticism or, you know, side-to-side movement for all of his career. But he will raise the IQ, the basketball IQ on the team. As much as I love Alec Burks, he had a lot of head-scratching moments over the course of his
He'll Utah fit Jackson. Great in Cleveland.
I was going to say, he's going to look amazing next to Jordan Clarkson.
Yikes.
But there's a boost in basketball IQ. I think Quinn Snyder will be smart about how he uses him. You made a point about somebody who can kind of break down a defense and then find Korver afterward. I think Mitchell still has that ability. He's gotten off to a pretty shaky start this season, especially with the 3-point shot. But maybe if he's got somebody to kick out to now, who's a little bit more reliable. Or have two kick-out options. I mean, he had Ingles, but now he's got two guys. Certainly there are things to be optimistic about, but I just think generally it still feels like kind of a weird return for him. And I was just telling myself during that game, too, is maybe they were bidding against somebody with Cleveland, too. That might explain this. Maybe Philly was serious about wanting Korver, so they had to up the ante a little bit. But
We were just saying in the last podcast about how there is, like, to a degree, there's a lot of teams that really, like, need these Cavs assets just because things are so competitive, and that means there's so few sellers right now that if you're looking to pick up a rotation player on the cheap, you know, there's Korver and George Hill if you got a bad deal that you want to send back. But like, there's not a lot of teams that are just like that. You look at them and go, oh, well, we can hit up Charlotte and try to steal a couple of their role players. You know, like a lot of those teams aren't really available right now. So it does stand to reason that Houston or especially Philly would be looking at these guys. I really think that this is a big loss for Houston, who just needs warm bodies. Every time a warm body goes off the market, that's a tough spot for Houston.
Houston is very interesting. They're 9-11 now. I think they just lost tonight, right?
They were getting wrecked by Dallas.
Yeah, Luka was torching them.
It's too early for me to take a victory lap on that, but I did think that Dallas would finish around 500. so consider this my warm up for my victory lap.
I feel really good because I predicted like last spring. I think I was on the Back to Back podcast, or I forget what it was called at the time. Probably Basketball Friends. It's been so many names, but I had said that I thought that Luka in the right situation or on a bad team would be able to put up 20 points per game. And the fact that he's doing it on a good team is really, really damn impressive. He's one hell of a player.
Did we can I stop us here to ask if Justin just patted himself on the back for thinking Luka would be good?
Yes. I got a lot of pushback.
I'll tell you what, buddy, that is probably a pretty unpopular take on NBA Twitter.
Carter. There's good, and then there's like 20 points per game good, okay?
And there are pockets of NBA Twitter that will still push back against Luka Doncic, believe it or not.
Well, duh. That's because they just,
but well, we know what. Circling back to the trade here, I do think one thing that is positive for Korver and the Jazz and the union there is Korver's a good system defender. Like, he'll get exposed in space at times, but the Jazz have Rudy Gobert, and they have guys that...
Being able to funnel there is great.
Right, yeah. And he's not going to be out of position. He's not going to lose guys off ball. And I think the strength of Jazz defense really is just how sound that system is. And I think he's going to slot in there and not be as big of a liability as some may think. And the other thing that's really positive too, as you said, the Jazz are lacking shooters, but while Korver for Burks is a swap of, okay, that's one of the two shooters they had. Now Burks is no longer there. Korver moves a lot more off ball, and he draws so much attention from the defense that I think that that's something that Quinn Snyder will be able to use and kind of use Korver as misdirection. You're focusing on him going off screens, and then all of a sudden there's a little pick and roll or a cut to the basket off ball and something that the Jazz will be able to kind of use and manipulate that movement to create offense. So I do think that he's probably going to play maybe a more significant role than some people think, just because they are so starved offensively right now.
And Burks was only playing 15 minutes a game. I would expect Korver to be up around 20 for this team. And I think, Justin, you made a really good point there, which is, I mean, I think Rudy Gobert is going to be slipping a lot of pin down screens for Korver.
Right,
for
right.
Easy oops. I mean, and his catch radius is so enormous that is actually really, really valuable. And I do think you're going to see Korver generate 6 to 8 points a game for the Jazz just by existing. And that's really what they don't have outside of Ingles. Because even Burks, like, I don't think that's a guy that I'm so scared of him shooting that
no.
I'm going to make a defensive mistake. It's more like, oh, damn, he made one. You know, there's such a difference in the level of panic that each guy inspires.
Yeah, I think that's all true. I think you guys have taken me from like mild excitement to legitimate excitement here.
Hey,
yeah, how about that? Plus, he's going to be really happy to be there. That's something I was really glad the Cavs did, which was they kind of seemed to care about doing right by these guys, at least a little bit. They sent him to Utah, somewhere Korver's played a significant. How many years did he play in Utah?
He was there for 2 or 3 seasons. It was the season that he set the three-point percentage record, though, was one of them. I know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he's been there before. He knows the area. He wanted to play on a team that has, you know, aspirations. I think you're going to get a pretty happy Korver.
He also has experience breaking the Warriors' hearts in the playoffs, so that at least when he was in Utah. At least when he was in Utah. Not so much in
Cleveland. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that conference finals team. for the Burke side of things, I'm not sure that how he plays matters in the grand scheme of things. I don't expect him to be on the Cavs next year. And this is really an asset move. But before we kind of look into what they can do with this contract, Andy, I am interested. What should Cavs fans be expecting? I was looking it up. His per 36 as compared to Rodney Hood are pretty fucking close.
They're going to be competing for minutes and time on the trainer's table and generally just kind of playing the same way.
Yeah, is he going to drive me as crazy as Rodney Hood drives me crazy? Like, how's his game both efficiency-wise and aesthetically?
Well, it depends on what night you catch him.
Okay. Yeah, that sigh and then that qualifier tells us a lot right off the bat.
Not a good start to the answer, I suppose. But aesthetically, so he earned that nickname Houdini from the Jazz play-by-play guy probably 4 or 5 years ago because he has these corkscrew drive and finishes in the lane that seem impossible, and he'll make 2 or 3 of them in a night, and you think, wow, this guy's really got something. He can get to the rim. When he's right, I think he can draw fouls. That's one difference between him and Hood. He's much better at drawing fouls, and hopefully the numbers back me up on that.
Mm-hmm. They do. His free throw rate's significantly higher.
So that's a plus. I think he's a pretty good passer, too. I don't think his numbers really show that, but when given the opportunity to kind of direct a set, I think he's an okay passer. I think he just falls back on his slashing ability a little bit too much. So maybe if you have a coach that can convince him to be more of a ball mover. Now, asking that of Larry Drew for a guy that's been in the league for 8 years, that's probably not going to happen. but maybe there's a little bit of potential there still.
Some secondary creation.
Yeah, and a guy who's good at attacking closeouts as a secondary creator, just like you mentioned. He's certainly different than Hood. The thing that was – Hood was inconsistent in a different way to me. He almost seemed like he would just disengage in a lot of those games.
I can corroborate that.
Yeah. If you need a third opinion, yeah. I think that's a fairly accurate description of the Rodney Hood experience.
Hey, and can you guys pause for a second? My daughter just started yelling for me.
Of course.
So Seth Rogen shaved.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. Not great, Bob.
I mean, he's been shaved before.
I don't remember clean shaved Seth Rogen.
He looks fine.
Yeah, not that bad.
He looks fine. You're a dick.
No, I just...
The day I shave, I'm not going to show you. That's for damn sure.
you don't want to see me clean shaved.
The beard is getting pretty unruly. I think Kylie's going to leave me soon if I don't trim it.
Mm-hmm. Fair.
Trey Kirby has a weird jump shot. He just tweeted out a video of him at a pickup game. It's like a catapult.
Getting follows from the starters is basically like the fucking Infinity Stones for me.
Dude, don't fucking say that.
What?
Don't make me jealous.
Oh, you mean Trey Kirby doesn't follow you?
Shut up. We get it. You're way higher profile. I'm never going to top 5K. I'll tell you that much. I have found my space in society. I'm the 4800 guy. And that's okay. I can handle that.
So Trey Kirby shoots like Peja.
Yeah, it's just, I guess Peja did kind of shoot that way. If you're tall, that's not a terrible release.
Nope.
Like, no one can block it. I really want to go play some pickup ball soon.
Fuck, I've only played pickup ball twice in the last 2 years since my surgery.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's hard.
That's really depressing.
Yeah.
That's tough. I wanted to get a membership at the Y.
All right, I'm back.
We should just leave our bullshit conversation. Trey Kirby's jump shot form.
Yeah, we talked about Seth Rogen shaving and Trey Kirby shooting like Peja Stojanovic.
Yes, you should leave those in. my daughter, we put her to bed like an hour ago, and she was apparently climbing on her dresser and fell off.
Oh, jeez. Well, you know.
Yeah.
All right, put some hair on her chest. Toughen her up. What were we talking about?
I can jump in because I was starting on a train of thought, so I can just jump in.
Go for it.
Take us home, country roads.
Oh, man. slight tangent there. I drove my wife crazy on our kind of wedding trip because I kept playing that every time we were driving through the mountains, and it drove her absolutely batshit.
Were you doing it ironically or just because you liked the song?
Bit of both.
Roads from now on?
Yeah, I think there is a positive there with Alec Burks being another competent ball handler, because the Cavs are still, even with Kyle Korver gone, they're still a team of a lot of specialists and guys that are used to playing off of someone that can create. And even though I don't anticipate him being around beyond the trade deadline, like I really do feel like trading him was just to get that expiring contract and a little bit of help for the time being.
Restock that second round pick chest, man. Jesus Christ.
Absolutely. Good point. To be fair, the Cavs have done better with the first pick of the second round over the last few years than they have with the first overall pick. I mean, you look at Andrew Bennett. Yeah, that about sums it up. Yeah, Andrew Bennett and Jetty Osman as the first pick of the second round. I'm going with the Turkish LeBron. So that Washington pick in particular is definitely a positive, and I think how this trade kind of grades out will also be dependent on what they're able to convert Burks into, if they're able to convert him into anything at all.
Yeah, before we kind of talk about that and the mechanics, I am curious, and this might be too in the weeds, Andy. Is this guy a pretty willing three-point shooter? Like, what kind of shooter is he? Is he a guy who really prefers to spot up? Does he like pulling off the dribble? Because that's been one of my biggest frustrations with Rodney Hood, is he would kind of attack slow approaching closeouts that he didn't really have an advantage on, instead of just pulling for what would have been an open three. What kind of shooter is Burks?
I think he's gotten steadily better over the last couple of years, and this year he's been pretty willing. He's got a 3-point attempt rate near 40, so that's good. And for a while he was shooting around 40. I think he's down to like 36 or 37% now. On his 3-point percentage, I think my general takeaway with him on everything is going to be, it depends on what night you catch him. He's just inconsistent, and that's the case for a lot of guys who are career bench players. They can't figure out how to sustain those good nights that they have.
Yeah, if he was consistent, he wouldn't be being traded for Kyle Korver, and
he'll have 2 seconds where, like, There was like a 2-week stretch last year where he was one of the best players on the Jazz. He averaged like 18, 19 points, was hitting threes, rebounding, defending, and then he'll just disappear for like a month. And then he showed up again in the playoffs. He was, you guys probably remember, he was good in the playoffs for the Jazz.
Yeah. Yeah.
That season, you just can't get that from him for more than like a week or two. I would say, you know, maybe some different situation will unlock consistency for him, but for a guy that's been in the league for 8 years, generally speaking,
you are what you are.
Exactly. When you've been around that long, it's, you kind of are what you are.
And this was something I had talked about just on Monday's podcast, but I just never can picture the Cavs being the franchise that turns a player around, no matter who it is. If they haven't figured it out yet, I don't really anticipate that changing here.
And do you think he's lost a lot to injury? Or from injuries? Like, because he's been pretty banged up over the course of his career. Like, yeah, do you think he lost anything from all those?
He maybe lost a little bit of explosion. I don't think he lost a ton. He maybe lost a little bit of confidence, although I don't think he's a guy who's really hurting for that either. But anytime you're a professional athlete and you miss most of 2 or 3 seasons, it's going to have some kind of an impact on you, but I don't think it's changed him as a player that much. So he's roughly the same. He's just doing it in a much different role than he did. I mean, he had those seasons before the injuries where it was starting to look pretty promising. He averaged 14 points a game for a couple years. And I still think he's relatively close to that player. He just doesn't play as much. And it makes sense because those Jazz teams that he was scoring on were the Ty Corbin era, which was – those are dark pretty days.
Talent deficient.
Yeah. So he's a guy who will – he will collect numbers if he's out there. They just may not be the most efficient or helpful numbers.
Well, I think we'll get a chance to see it no matter how long he is with the Cavs. And correct me if I'm wrong on the rules here, Justin. I think I'm right. Right now, one of the values of adding Burks is that they can trade him before the deadline. He's got a $10 to $11 million expiring contract, more additional salary that the Cavs can send out and take back some bad contracts and maybe get a good asset paired with it. It's they can trade him today, but he can't be paired with another player. Has to wait another 60 days in order to be traded with another player, and that's right before the deadline. Do you expect him to be on this team past February 15th?
No, I do not. It'll be really interesting to see kind of what they do, because in theory, especially if you pair him with someone like George Hill, who is owed $20 million this season and then only $1 million guaranteed next year, you could theoretically give a team, okay, when you combine him and Alec Burks together, that's like $31.5 million with only $1 million guaranteed for next season. Like, there should be value in that. And the Cavs in the past, or at least in the post-decision era, what they did was they took on a lot of money in exchange for assets. And if Dan Gilbert continues to be willing to spend, that seems to be the best way to go about it, because I just can't imagine Cleveland really being a free agent destination until you start to get to that point where you've accumulated enough talent where guys like role players and guys that you're looking to fill out the roster are willing to go there, because it seems like a good basketball situation. They're not going to do it just because it's a free agent destination. So to me, having Burks as a potential guy that you can throw in along with George Hill or even potentially J.R. Smith, I think that's something that could be attractive to another team.
Yeah, I can't stop looking at that Hornets payroll with Batum, Biombo, MKG, and Zeller. That they've got like a combined like $150 million in dead or in guaranteed money remaining on those deals. It's like outrageous, and it just feels like they might just be ripe for the picking, where if you could say, hey, we'll send you George Hill and Alec Burks, two guys who will help your team get a little bit better, because that is a kind of a not very good roster, and we'll take on this horrible money that's just hamstringing your future, but we want an unprotected first, or we want Miles Bridges. Andy, do you think that is – kind of a spot where the Cavs might be able to take advantage, or do you think they just don't have the assets to pull off this kind of deal?
I think that's the right angle for a team in Cleveland's position to attack from. You now have some movable deals. The George Hill one is really intriguing to me, because he's a guy that can still help a team too, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
So not necessarily just a salary dump potential there. But yeah, they've got a lot of pieces that are really interesting. Is J.R. Smith fully guaranteed next season?
No, only for like $2 million, I think.
Yeah, okay. I think just like 3.2 is the figure, or 3.
So they've got a bunch of interesting options, and I think it was Carter who earlier said that Cleveland is one of the only sellers out there. And I think it's kind of funny that I think Utah could be a seller too. I'm not sure if they will be, but they have a lot of these kind of contracts too. Like Rubio's expiring, Favors is completely non-guaranteed next year. And I, you know, some teams are willing to do things like this and some are not, but I think the right tact is what you guys have described, where you can sort of strike when the iron's hot here, take on a bad contract. You're not going to be good for the next 2 or 3 years anyway. You might as well just eat that money and get a first round pick. Somebody told me on Twitter today, in like all capital letters, tanking doesn't work. And it's just crazy to me, especially for teams like Cleveland or Utah or some of these other small market teams. you're not going to build a super team through free agency. You've got to do it with shrewd moves like the ones that you've described. You've got to pick up extra assets. You've got to hit in the draft a few times. You've got to find some hidden value in players in the trade market. It's just a lot more difficult for teams like the Cavs and the Jazz to really put together strong squads than it is for like the Lakers, who can be dreadful for 5 years and just like walk backwards into LeBron James.
Well, in fairness, the Cavs walked backwards into LeBron James twice.
Very fair.
How hard can it really be, Andy? Like, it's simple to me.
Jazz probably failed by not being able to sign him this summer.
Utah fans just need like the next greatest player of all time to be born in Salt Lake, and they'll be set.
Yeah, at least Provo, you know, that's like Akron. That's Salt Lake's Akron. No, it's not. It does just seem like, also given this pretty star-studded free agency class and all these teams with these big free agency dreams, some of whom who still need to open up the room to even do it. You know, look at the Knicks with a Tim Hardaway Jr. Contract. Mm-hmm. Grizzlies still sitting on that horrible Chandler Parsons deal. There's just a lot of bad money out there that teams really should be looking to get off of. And, you know, old Uncle Dan might have open arms if he's smart. But
I don't exactly care how he spends his money. So as long as he's willing to spend it, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, and to Andy's point about like, oh, you know, don't tank. Like, it's not like the Cavs aren't already currently tanking.
Right, like, absolutely.
Like, they're doing their best, and they've got the worst record in the league. Like, it doesn't really make a huge difference to me if they sell off their guys midseason.
Yeah, and the tricky thing is, with the lottery reform, it's not as though it removed tanking as being like a viable option for these teams to add talent. It still is basically the only way to go about it. The new odds just kind of decrease your likelihood of getting a guy that matters when you're bad. But the Cavs just have to put themselves in a position to get as many lottery tickets as possible. Get as many picks as you can and have as many kind of cracks at it as you possibly can. Cause I mean, and I've complained about this before, but you get the worst record in the league, you still have like a 48% chance of having the fifth pick in a draft. So if they could get, as Carter said, like an unprotected first out of a team like Charlotte, or just any pick, just infuse young talent in there. And even if you're not getting kind of that once in a generation superstar, if you draft well, you can consolidate some of those assets and hopefully eventually make a move down the road. I mean, look at Toronto, for example. Toronto is a team where they weren't drafting high, but they drafted well at the positions that they drafted. And I mean, basically three of their top four players were drafted after the 20th pick. Like these are all kind of late finds, and the Cavs might not have the best draft history, but the more kind of shots you have and the more picks you have, the better your chances are of adding someone that matters.
Yeah,
I totally agree with that.
I do want to pivot over to the Jazz because, Andy, you're sort of talking about them like they are the Cavs, and it's kind of depressing me.
It really depressed me, man.
Yeah, obviously, this team isn't playing well. They're 10-12 on the season after beating Brooklyn tonight. I mean, how do you feel? Do you feel like this is an anomaly? Do you feel like something's a little broken in this team? Do you think it's as simple as last year they just overperformed and now everyone's, you know, coming back to what they really are? What is your diagnosis of this Jazz team?
I feel like something is a little bit broken. I think there's a little bit of truth to maybe all of those options that you threw out.
Yikes.
When everybody was projecting them to finish, like, I mean, I even saw a piece from Chris Herring at 538 that said they were a title contender, and I saw people saying they're number two in the West and no worse than fourth, and I was really uncomfortable with all of that. Because
it's a lot of people that seem to think growth is linear.
Yeah, for sure. And I was always worried that are they going to be like that Miami Heat team that had an amazing close and then kind of came back to what they really were the next season? Or the Phoenix Suns several years before that, when they were supposed to be tanking and they won like 48 games. I was worried something like that would happen. And I'm kind of thinking that that might be confirmed by these first 20 odd games, however many they've played. It's too early to say that's true for certain. But there are some issues. Like I've already mentioned, the shooting. This is probably something that they should have seen coming, coming into the season. Ricky Rubio, for his career, is a terrible shooter. One of the all-time worst, to be honest. We all had a good chuckle about Jay Crowder shooting. He's had one good shooting season his entire career, below average three-point shooter for his career numbers. Dante Exum, way below average career three-point shooter. They're trying to turn Derek Favors into a corner threat, and that's not working. I think he's shooting like 20% right now. With the exception of Ingles, there was just really nobody who could command any attention around the three-point line. And in 2018, if you don't have shooters, you're pretty much cooked. So that was something that they probably should have seen coming. All the expectations around Donovan Mitchell were probably a little bit too big for him to live up to. He was really good at adapting last year, so maybe he'll make some more adjustments this year and sort of bounce back. But he's been off to a rough start as well. This is my long-winded, rambling way of saying that I don't think that this disappointment should be all that much of a surprise. There were definitely some issues lingering on this roster before the season even started.
So if it makes you feel better, I don't think Donovan Mitchell is Dion Waiters. So I don't think you're quite in territory.
Thank goodness.
I guess my question to you is, like, I mean, you say that the three-point shooting isn't there, and you look up and down the roster and you say, well, that sounds about right, but last year they were passable. Is it as simple as a couple guys shot above their heads and now crashed back to earth? It's just a little weird. You know, it's like I kind of felt this way about the Rockets a little bit, where it's like so obvious that roster is so terrible now.
Yeah, it is.
But then, like, in the summer, it was like, oh, well, you know, they lost a guy or two, but they should be fine. And then it's like, oh, they only have five players. I feel the same way about the Jazz. Like, okay, they, you know, Jarebko is not there. You know, Hood's not there. Whatever. Who cares? Yeah. And then all of a sudden, there's nobody.
Yeah, when you were saying that, I thought, well, the only guy who left was Jarebko, and that shouldn't have been enough to make this big of a difference. So maybe it was just like incremental drop-off from all these guys this season. And obviously there's still time for a lot of these numbers to recover. But if we just look at the overall sample size from these guys' careers, there just aren't a lot of shooters on this roster. And then the other problem, the other day I was just kind of poring over their team numbers and I came down to two real problems. One is the shooting. The other is turnovers. They cough the ball up like crazy. If you watch the Jazz, especially when Ricky Rubio is on the floor, he's just chucking that thing all over the place, and he doesn't seem to care who's on the other end of that pass. He throws the ball all over the place. Joe Ingles is pretty loose with it. Dante Exum, now in his fifth year in the NBA, doesn't appear to have learned much about ball handling in that entire time.
The Exum excitement always has made no sense to me.
I'm still in on Exum, and I don't quite understand the way that they've developed him. But objectively speaking, just from like a zoomed out perspective, he has not been good.
He so rarely makes me say wow, and he's not solid enough. Like, and it's not like
what really put me back on him was the 14 games he played at the end of the last season, and it was like, okay, this is what we
buy to you, dude.
Yeah, exactly. I thought, well, this is what we've been waiting for 3 or 4 years, and now this year he looks as bad as he ever has. So who knows what's going on with him? But all those turnovers, everybody's been talking about Utah's defense taking a step back. It's because they're constantly coughing the ball up and giving people fast breaks. So if they can, maybe Korver helps the 3-point shooting. He should. And if they can control the ball a little bit better, maybe they can start to get this thing going in the right direction.
Yeah. So you don't think the issue was letting Derrick Rose go?
Just so we're clear.
I just want to just kind of cross that off the list.
Revenge game of the year right there, by the way.
I
50 on the Jazz. That was embarrassing.
Profoundly weird game. It is kind of – it does feel like the shooting and the turnovers are related to one another. Just from the perspective of there's no room. Yeah, you have a lot more tight windows to fit passes in when the – floor is shrunk against you. I mean, I think Utah is always going to be a team that's going to turn the ball over a lot just because they run a motion passing offense, you know? Like we always talk about those old ISO Joe Hawks teams and how they were always better offensive rating teams than we thought they should have been just because they didn't turn the ball over because no one passed. Yeah. They got a shot up every possession. It feels like Utah is just naturally going to be a team that's going to give the ball up a little bit because they're not an ISO team. They run that nice, intricate Quinn Snyder offense, but that does seem to be a natural thing. Do you think the defense really has – do you really think that's as simple as why the defense has stepped back, though, is that they're turning it over more?
No, I don't think that's the only reason. I do think it's a big one and one that
– 27th in turnover rate this year at 15.8, and they were 23rd last year. So – not good last year, but way worse.
Yeah. And I think right now they're like, I think there's only one team giving up more points off turnovers than them. So it's not good, but there's
like
also
super harmful turnovers. Like they're not all turnovers are created equal.
Yeah. So you make a good point. One thing that happens to them a lot is, and you also brought up Quinn Snyder's intricate offense, which I think is just too intricate sometimes. I think, especially now with Kyle Korver, they would be better off just running a Donovan Mitchell, Rudy Gobert pick and roll with Korver and Ingles on either wing. But instead they'll do all this sort of mumbo jumbo, pass the ball from a guard to the big 5 feet outside the 3-point line. That pass gets picked off all the time because teams know it's coming.
Yep. Cavs get that. We'll get pick sixed a lot on random tosses to Larry Nance.
It's really weird. And then the end result of that offense a lot of times is all of a sudden Joe Ingles or Donovan Mitchell has the ball 25 feet to the rim from the rim with 5 seconds left on the shot clock.
And you end up running a pick and roll. That's how it often plays.
You spent the entire shot clock trying to create a mismatch. Whether or not you get one, it's maybe not even that useful by that time. So sometimes I think it's just overthought the offense a little bit, and there are bad turnovers. But the other thing, getting back to your question about the defense, is I think the freedom of movement changes have probably hurt them a little bit. I think that's maybe overstated some because they should be able to adjust to that. But they did have some physical defenders, like Royce O'Neal was pretty good at hounding people off the ball. Dante Exum was pretty good at hounding people off the ball as well. So maybe that's impacting it some. Some people have pointed to Rudy Gobert maybe not playing as hard as he did last year. I'm not sure I fully buy that. I think a lot of the bad rap on him this year is because guards get blown by constantly. So he's just constantly under attack. So
right.
There's a bunch of issues. But I do think the turnovers are a pretty big one.
Is there a fix that you have in mind? Like I don't think I'm as low on the Jazz as you are. I do think that they're probably going to turn it around. Like when I'm looking at, I still view them as a near lock to make playoffs. I think there's just too much talent there. I think Donovan Mitchell is going to kind of bounce back. Not that he's been bad, but I just think that he has another gear to go to. And as Carter said earlier, growth isn't necessarily linear and everyone kind of thinks that way. Sometimes you take a step back before you take a few strides forward. But do you feel as though there's a trade they might pursue or do some sort of in-season fix that they might go after? Or do you think they're just going to kind of run it as is for this season and hope that that's enough?
I think they're probably at least still poking around the trade market. They were really high on Otto Porter the summer that Gordon Hayward. So if Washington in full scale blow it up mode and their number one goal is just getting off money, Utah is a team that can help. Like I said earlier, they've got a bunch of expiring contracts. And so they can help them get out of quite a bit of money. And he, as a stretch four next to Gobert, makes a lot of sense to me. So that's interesting.
Are you
to me.
Pretty much ready to scuttle the too big experiment?
I mean, I was at the beginning of last season. And obviously Quinn Snyder kept pushing forward with it. And eventually it started working. The second half of the season, all of a sudden Ricky Rubio learned how to shoot for a couple months and things looked much, much different. But it's been awful this season. And the interesting thing is, you know, Jay Crowder shoots less than 30% from three, but the offense is still so much more spaced out and just looks way more comfortable when he's out there because defenders at least have to think about going out there to defend.
Same thing when for the Cavs when poor David Nwaba has been playing the four, even though he can't hit the broadside of a barn. It's just different than when they have the dual center lineup in because you just naturally want to close out on the wing.
Yeah, and that's a good way to put it too, dual center. I think we should probably stop saying it's like a traditional big lineup because Derek Favors is a center. There's no way around in 2018. And to continue to try this experiment, it's not really – I mean, it's been the starting lineup for 3 or 4 years, so maybe calling an experiment isn't true. But every time they've started a game with that lineup, Rubio – Ingles, Mitchell, Favors, and Gobert. Afterward, I'll mark down the plus minus of the starting lineup. And on the season, when they play teams that are healthy, they're something like minus 15 points per 48 minutes when those starters are on the floor. It's just not.
Yeah.
You continue to sort of bang your head against the wall with that lineup just does not make sense to me. So in answer to that question, yeah, I think it's time to move on and try to play a little bit more modern basketball. And if you got to go out and make a trade to make that happen, then I think, you know, Dennis Lindsay needs to aggressively do that. I don't know if he will, but I'm sure they're at least looking around.
I think the Otto Porter fit would be really interesting because I think that's one guy that when I look around the league and say, okay, who's been underutilized or hasn't been used properly, that kind of does have that upside that I believe could kind of put it together if he was maximized and put in the right situation. He's one of those guys that's at the top of the list. And actually, a Favors trade would be really interesting to me because I'm still a believer in Derek Favors. I think if he was a team's full-time starting center, that he would kind of excel in that role as long as it's a situation where he's being used properly. So that might be something that's kind of mutually beneficial. But if you had to guess, Andy, do you think the Jazz turn it around this year? Like if you're going to do a little prognosticating here.
I think they probably make the playoffs like you do. Okay. I don't think they're a lock. And I honestly didn't think they were a lock even coming into the season. My idea was that I thought Houston would be better. I thought they were still pretty firmly in second. And I thought 3 through 13 was going to be kind of a mess. The two teams I figured would be out for sure were the Kings and the Suns. And I've turned out to maybe be wrong about the Kings. We'll see how they look.
Yeah, I think it's such a mess. It's just impossible to know. Like,
yeah. So, I mean, they could still – I think recover and win, you know, 45, 46 games and miss the playoffs. I don't know what we call a success, but I do think they probably make the playoffs. I'm just not completely sure they will.
The West is so weird that like seeds 3 through 8 in the playoffs in the West might win between 43 and 46 games. Like that's the thing. Like the West is so good and deep, but it's so not great. Like, it's so mediocre in its goodness. It's like a bunch of 46-win teams right now. It's so strange.
Beat up on each other is a big part of it.
Yeah, but it feels a little different than just beating up on each other because they always beat up on each other. And, the Kings are better than we think they are, but there is a true lack of a second and even a third tier in the West right now. It's just so strange. I can't make heads or tails of any of these teams.
I do expect the Kings to take a step back at some point. I've kind of been thinking about that about the Grizzlies too, although they seem more real to me every day. But the other thing that's weird about the West is now really the only team that you can look at on the schedule and say that's a win is the Suns.
Right.
Pretty much every Western Conference opponent, it's generally speaking going to be competitive. I say that as somebody watches a lot of Jazz basketball and they've been blown out by 50 and 40. So take that with a grain of salt. But there's just so many good teams in that conference.
Yeah, I guess my question is, do you think that it feels like you feel like the parity in the records in the West is a byproduct of everyone being so good? I am kind of the opinion that everyone's kind of not as good as usual. That the teams at the top are not as good as usual, and that's causing it. Justin, where do you land?
I think right now in the West, what we're seeing is a lot of teams that are talented and their ceiling when they're playing well is very high, but you don't necessarily. That doesn't happen on a consistent basis. Like Denver, when Denver's playing well, can play with anybody in the league, but the floor isn't necessarily as high. Portland's a very good regular season team, but as we've seen, that hasn't necessarily translated to the playoffs. And I think that's a little what you were talking to, Carter, is Blazers were third seed last year. They don't win a single playoff game. And there certainly is parity, but I find on a week-to-week basis or even a game-to-game basis, a lot of these Western teams just aren't playing consistently. And I'm not necessarily saying that that's exclusive to the Western Conference. I mean, the amount of just bad teams in the East. And
The East definitely has more bad teams. That is without doubt.
And teams with a lot lower floors. But the West just has like a really interesting collection of talent on a lot of teams, and Denver and Utah are kind of the teams that really jump to mind of teams.
I think the West has a ceiling problem, man. I don't think any of these teams other than the Warriors are better than a B.
Better than a B?
A B overall. Like
I thought you said
I don't
B.
See
a, I was a like, B. What the hell?
No, I don't see a B plus. I don't see an A minus. I see B's and B minuses across the board.
I think there's a couple teams with pretty high ceilings. Like, I think Denver could be really, really good.
What does really, really good mean, though? Like, a finals contender? Like, even in a normal league, that does not feel like a best team in the West. Like, let's say the Warriors weren't crazy, broken, and throwing off our idea of how good a team could be. Like, I don't see it, man. It doesn't land. I don't think that any of these teams are exceptional.
Well, I think title contender is relative as long as the Warriors exist.
Yeah,
Saying even in a non-Warriors world, I don't think these
Warriors universe. I think that the Nuggets maybe have that kind of a ceiling. I mean,
they remind me of the Raptors the last 4 years, but
hey.
I mean, they haven't proven anything in the playoffs yet. I mean,
or made them.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. They haven't even been in a series yet, most of those guys. So there's still a lot to prove for teams like that. I still think Utah has a pretty high ceiling. I don't think they're a title contender, though. So maybe I'm like tepidly agreeing with you.
Fair.
Well, Andy, really appreciate you coming on. I'm fascinated by the Jazz. So we might bug you later on the season and see which way this is kind of going because, as you said, they're a team that does have a high ceiling. I think that's an opinion you and I both share there. And this Western Conference plays out will be absolutely fascinating. It's one of the reasons why I think it's so interesting that the Lakers decided to do absolutely nothing to really bolster that team outside of LeBron. So we'll see how all these gambles in the West pull off. I think we're going to see an arms race down the stretch where teams like Houston and Utah will kind of be jockeying to put themselves in a better position come playoffs. But as I said, really appreciate you coming on. We'll be keeping a close eye on the Jazz. Do you want to plug your stuff before we wrap this up?
Sure. Just come find me on Twitter @AndrewDBailey. Most of the stuff that I share, I will put on there.
Twitter brings the people together. All right. Thanks again, Andy. Thanks to our listeners. Remember, support the podcast by leaving a rating, a review, subscribe, unsubscribe, resubscribe. And if you want to be part of our Discord chat, you can send a screenshot of that review to chasedownpod@gmail.com, and we will be more than happy to send you an invite. Thanks again to Andy. Thanks to Carter for putting up with me as my always faithful co-host. And until next time, go Cavs.